McGill Daily of the Daily.
I'm McGill Daily.
Hi, I'm calling from the McGill Daily. Can I ask you some questions?
This is a little bit problematic.
News. Could I see you for a second?
We're going to cap this.
News, can you dummy?
Did that story come in yet?
Editorial's in 5 minutes.
McGill Daily.
Unfit to print.
You're listening to Unfit to Print, a McGill Daily and CKUT news collaboration. I'm your host, Chantal Schultz. Unfit to Print is a student-produced, bi-weekly show that brings the latest of McGill and Montreal news. Today's episode features an interview with Damon Davis, an artist, community organizer, and Black Lives Matter activist from St. Louis, Missouri. On November 12th, Davis gave the keynote presentation for Culture Shock, an event series about migrant justice, anti-racism, and Indigenous solidarity, organized by the Quebec Public Interest Research Group, QPIRG, McGill. In the interview, you'll hear Davis explain his project, All Hands on Deck, The Power of Art, and his thoughts on the election of Donald Trump. Then you'll hear excerpts from a lecture on November 10th by Rabab Abdelhadi, titled Revising the Narrative, Critiquing the Canon, Palestine and Feminist Paradigms. Abdelhadi is a Palestinian scholar and activist and professor at San Francisco State University. Her lecture challenged the assumptions in academic literature that Palestinian men view women as lesser than in national movements and examined who, in the feminist canon, is considered a feminist. But first, headlines. For months, the Standing Rock Sioux have been fighting against the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which threatens the Missouri River, an essential source of fresh water for the nation. On Monday, November 7th, a rally took place at Victoria Square, where demonstrators stood in solidarity with those at Standing Rock. The goal of the protest was to put pressure on Canadian banks that are funding the pipeline, also known as the DAPL, and other pipelines across the U.S. and Canada. Protesters marched to the Montreal headquarters of the Royal Bank of Canada and were met with police officers who were unwilling to allow them access to the building, despite possessing RBC bank cards. In the end, several protesters were able to confront branch representatives and withdrew their money from the bank. Roughly 200 demonstrators marched down Saint-Denis on Wednesday, November 9th, to protest Donald Trump's election as the next U.S. president. Speakers at the rally, held at the corner of Ontario and Deloremier, emphasized the need for solidarity with marginalized populations, with rising far-right sentiments across Europe and North America. Organizers also spoke to the relevance of an anti-fascist movement in Quebec, noting that the Parti Québécois, in addition to having a history of perpetuating Islamophobia, has taken extensive security measures to prevent these types of demonstrations. Attendees expressed hope that more people would be mobilized to oppose fascism and to stand in solidarity with marginalized communities. On Monday, November 7th, the Joint Board Senate Committee on Equity, Subcommittee on Queer People, hosted a forum in Thompson House to discuss issues facing the LGBTQ community on campus. The forum was facilitated by Lynn Kozak, chair of the subcommittee, who led participants to take part in group discussions. Topics included the lack of centralized community, visibility of queer issues, diversity in curricula, and gender-neutral bathrooms on campus. The issue of dead naming, the act of referring to a trans person's birth name rather than chosen name, was also identified as an institutional problem. The forum also discussed the initiatives that are and can be taken to tackle the outlined issues, including mandatory equity-based workshops and training for students and faculty. For more in-depth coverage of these stories and for other McGill and Montreal news, pick up a copy of the McGill Daily on stands now or visit our website at mcgilldaily.com/news. Now you'll hear an interview with Damon Davis, an artist, community organizer, and Black Lives Matter activist from St. Louis, Missouri. Davis gave the keynote presentation for Culture Shock, an event series about migrant justice, anti-racism, and Indigenous solidarity, organized by QPIRG McGill. In the interview, Davis explains his project, All Hands on Deck, the power of art and activism, and his thoughts on the election of Donald Trump. First of all, could you talk about your project, All Hands on Deck?
It was basically to lift the morale of the people that was out there. It was very cold. It was deep in the fight. And people had already started boarding up the businesses out on West Florissant. And it just looked it was very depressing. It was, you know, the kids had to go to school and that, and people had to go to work. And it was almost like it looked as though a war had already happened, and came up with the idea that we paste these hands up all over these boards. And then also set up a website and made it, I guess, free to the public to download them and put them up everywhere that they could. So it spread all over the world for lack of a better word, people in India, Lithuania, England, Africa, Ghana in Africa, all over the place was putting it up. And that was that, and not to mention all over the country. And it was just something for the people and the people I knew. Everybody that was in those pictures, the people that I knew, they played different roles. Some people were live streamers, so that was like the news for the people. Some people were organizers. Some people were ran shops that they made safe spaces for people when the police would attack people. But all of those, or they were children of organizers or children. But everybody, all of those people were people that I knew personally that were very involved in the fight, the rebellion, and they weren't just like community members. That was the community of people that were involved in the protest. Not so much just people from Ferguson, but like people that came to Ferguson specifically to fight for justice for Mike Brown.
So what's the importance of allowing other people to like download the images and put them up versus maybe having like an exhibition in a certain space?
Exhibitions usually seem kind of stuffy to me, and especially around projects like this. This was made for people in the street and what was going on in the street. So that's why I thought it was important for people to be able to take it to their street. And since then, you know, the images have been displayed in galleries and in museums. I'm not opposed to it, but it was made for everybody, for the people. And the problem with art as an institution is that it's very it's classes, and it separates certain people. And certain people don't think that they should be allowed in, or don't think that those spaces are made for them. So I was making that art for the people that thought that those spaces weren't for them. And when it hits, and when it gets to a museum or a gallery, my hope is that it makes the people that are in there as uncomfortable with those images as the people on the outside are with the institution themselves.
Can you talk about the relationship between art and activism for you?
For the most part, I think there is no, the relationship is they are the same thing. And I think that art is probably the most powerful weapon we have when it comes to changing the hearts and minds of people. Like, you could, voting, we see what voting does. We see what trying to plead your case to people does. Art is something that can cut through a lot of the armor that people put on so that they don't feel guilty for their actions and or their culpability in a system that is hurting someone else. Because a lot of people can turn and look away, or they can insulate themselves in their privilege and never really have to deal with certain things and the fact that they benefited off of the pain of someone else. Art is something that in an instant it can convey a message and just destroy that, like break that down instantly. And people are left, they are left to have to sit in it for a second. And I don't know what else can have that kind of effect on people, because it is a war. There are different tactics. This is the one that may leave people alive long enough to change. Other things don't do that, you know. So I think it's all of the tools and all of the weapons are useful, but this is just the one that I'm good at and I choose to use, you know.
What are your thoughts on the most recent election? You said that you weren't surprised.
I was watching and I couldn't believe in the initial moments, like, this is really happening, like, this is really gonna happen, you know. But I'm not surprised by what white supremacy will do to protect itself. Like, it's not that's not new to me or anybody that I know, and I've been disappointed a lot, especially over the last few years with the government and everything. So at this point, like, you know what I mean, like, I'm just not surprised by what, like, I'm not surprised by white people and what they do and how they feel. And I also understand that, like my the white people I'm around and the friends I got are not normal white people, and they definitely ain't representative of the white people that I live, like, that I, the state I live in. You know what I mean? Like, we get insulated in these bubbles because of the internet or whatever, and you think that everybody's an activist or everybody's so forward thinking, and they not. And they just showed, they just showed you the whole, like, that, like, they would rather have this dude in there. And I got problems with Hillary Clinton too. So, like, let's be honest about that. Like, neither one of them were good choices. Not for the people that I come from, and not for the people that that I love and the people I care about. We wasn't gonna make it on their ballot anyway. But the difference is like, a person like that makes it okay for people to be openly hateful, and so, like, the danger level is higher than it would have been. But the danger level ain't going nowhere, and it ain't gonna change for us. They just do it in quiet. So that's what I mean by, like, I'm not surprised. I woke up black the day before that shit happened. I'm waking up black today. You know what I mean? So it's like that. It's always going to be there for me, and it's kind of good for black people to think they outside of that, so that they understand that, like, yeah, the world ain't where you live and how much money you get and all of that. That's not gonna change anything. It's also good for these white liberals that think that that thought that, like, the people that the society had moved further. You know what I'm saying? Like, wake up and be like, this is what we going through every day. So, like, I'm not surprised, but, like, I know your heart is broken, but we got to get up and go through it every day. So, like, it ain't no time to be heartbroken or nothing like that, because you finally get a taste of what I've been going through with my father, my mother, what they, like, that's what we do. We get stepped on, and we have to get up and go through it. So, like, I don't got no sympathy for these white people that's hearts just so broken by this. Like, get over it. If you really about the fight, then get back in it. You figure it out. You know what I'm saying? Because it ain't my problem to figure out. I was born in it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have the option to check out either. You know what I mean? So, like, I'm just like, I was kind of jaded before. And I mean, it's an extraordinary time to be alive, to watch this unfold, and we'll see where we gonna be at. But, like, I'm just very disappointed in humanity. Like, this hasn't happened before. And, like, this type of stuff, like, if you're supposed to learn from mistakes of the past, and, like, it's 1942 again. So, like, either we're going to deal with this right now, or we're going to watch it escalate and the same thing's going to happen. You know what I mean? But I was a target before this. I'm a target now. So I'm not really overly surprised by what happened.
Yeah, and I think it's also an opportunity for a lot of people who have stayed silent to start organizing.
Yeah.
It's like a wake-up call, although it really shouldn't be a wake-up call.
Yeah, but I agree. I guess it takes something super extreme, and it takes you being the victim. You know what I mean? Like, it takes you being the target now. Like, now he targeting everybody that ain't a straight white man. So, like, now all of these people that could be quiet and be like, you know what, maybe he shouldn't have stole the cigars, and maybe, yeah, that's over with now. So now it's like, now that you can't check out, because eventually he'll be coming for you. You know what I mean? And I was already here, so, like, I'm not really tripping off of that, for real.
So I also know you have a project called Negrophilia. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah. So that was on display. That was on display at the Mercado in Brooklyn, and it just came down November 6th. It was up for a couple of months, but it was basically, I did these 6x6 small collage pieces. I did over 130 of them, I believe, 130, 115, somewhere in between there. And the basic premise, I started making them as, like, therapy pieces. I was making them during the Ferguson Rebellion, like the heated months, and I just kept making them because the internet was, it played two roles. Like, it was good in the beginning. We could spread the message of what was going on, and we could tell people, we kept the public informed. But after a while, it would just be these pictures of these black people being killed and these videos. And after a while, I figured out that it wasn't serving us anymore. It was almost serving the state, because it was desensitizing people to the real life imagery of black people being murdered. And it served two purposes. Like, black people, kids, black people, that's showing you No matter, we could catch it on tape. Nobody's going to jail. Nobody's going to trial. You know what I mean? Nobody cares. So it shows you that your life means even less than what you thought it meant. It also shows white people, it gives them an out, like, well, they not going to jail, so they must have did something wrong, and I don't know nobody getting shot, so everybody cares less about black life. You know what I mean? And that's what I meant by, not only do they care less about the actual person, it's these actual individual lives being lost, it gets thrown into a homogenized internet culture that's just like a hashtag and like metadata and statistics of people dying, and people are so infatuated with sharing that and watching that, but people lose sight of the actual, there's like, that person that just died was somebody's son or somebody's daughter, somebody's father, somebody's mother, somebody's child, you know, and nobody, like, we lose that, but we get riled up in these hashtags and all of that, you know, and in 30 seconds you'll forget about that person anyway because another one will die. You know, and so that idea of negrophilia, but the infatuation with watching black people die and the cultural phenomenon of watching black people die was something that I was exploring, just something that was bothering me a lot. And so a lot of that was wrapped up in that. A lot of personal situations with my own family and watching black people die in different ways, whether it was because of health or mental issues, but also like, watching black people strive through it. So it was just a lot going on in those months and that time around while I was creating that project. But the basic thing was talking about the two-pronged approach was the infatuation with black people dying and the realization and the realization of how real mortality is for black people and how they have to be like death is real for you. As soon as you like a 3-year-old knows what death is and knows what it means when they black and you know, and white people do not have that realization for real until like, oh, well, somebody died in a car accident when I was in high school and oh, I will die. You know, like I know some, but like it's people, we like people are dying around us from the beginning. And like the realization of your own mortality is thrust upon black children much earlier than any other race of people that I have come in contact with, at least in America. You know, so like just that idea that black people die, and what does that mean to you from where you stand? Is it something that you're infatuated with? Is it something that's another hashtag, another marketing tool? Is it something that you have to, like, you losing people on a day-to-day basis? What kind of mental strain does that put on you? But just the idea of America's fascination with black death was like on and how broad the broadest and eclectic ways that plays out in society was what my main goal was with that series.
You just heard an interview with Damon Davis, an artist and Black Lives Matter activist from St. Louis, Missouri. To view his work, go to heartacheandpaint.com. Now you'll hear excerpts from the November 10th lecture by Rabab Abdelhadi titled Revising the Narrative, Critiquing the Canon, Palestine and Feminist Paradigms. Abdelhadi is a Palestinian scholar and activist and professor at San Francisco State University. Her lecture challenged the assumptions in academic literature that Palestinian men view women as lesser than in national movements and examined who in the feminist canon is considered a feminist. She spoke about the indivisibility of justice, how when we fight for justice, it should be for justice everywhere, and no single struggle, including the Palestinian one, is exceptional.
I first stand by honoring the people, the indigenous people in whose land, stolen land, we convene. And I also send greetings to Standing Rock, the heroic people who are actually showing the whole world that regardless who gets elected in the United States, 2 days ago, people are struggling. People are struggling, people defending their land, people are defending their water, and the whole world is joining. They started by themselves, and then everybody joined with that, as well as the people who are fallen in the streets of Montreal, in the streets of San Francisco, and in the streets of Palestine, South Africa, Haiti, Puerto Rico, Philippines, and elsewhere. I'm an organizer. I was an organizer before I became a scholar. And I became a scholar in order for us to be able to kind of like learn more and speak more about the struggle for justice, not only for Palestine, everywhere.
She explained her current research project and mentions that she hasn't been able to finish it because of the harassment she's experienced, as she has been targeted for her politics and anti-Zionist views, and has been put on multiple websites that, quote-unquote, expose pro-Palestinian activists.
This is my book project that I have been trying to finish forever, and the reason we can talk about that, but the reason I haven't been able to finish it is sort of like the stuff that's been going on, so we can talk about that later. So this is the abstract for the book in general. How do diverse women's movements fare in different socio-historical contexts? What's the relationship between women's organizing around gender and sexuality and their lived realities? This project asks these theoretical questions in the context of Palestine, focusing on three periods. The colonial context of the Israeli occupation, now go way back towards the beginning of the 20th century until, quote-unquote, the first intifada. The post-colonial context, and that's in parenthesis as well, that extends from the signing of the 1993 Oslo Accords between Israel and the PLO and includes the second intifada, which we call the Aqsa Intifada, and a mix of colonial and post-colonial context, which has been sharpened by different contexts. Today, I want to focus on only one slice. I'm more than happy to share the various chapters and so on. I want to talk about the whole question of gender resistance and movements, and how do we think about the questions of borders, margins, and boundaries. So these are some of the questions on my mind that I was thinking about. How do these terms come up in my intellectual and organizing work? And I want to say that everything that Michelle spoke about, this is not by myself. This is something that is part of a collective process. I'm part of a collective process that produced the context in which I became an organizer, and it's part of a political context in which I am organizing that a lot of people are joining. So how do these terms come up in my intellectual and organizing work as a scholar for whom an indivisible sense of justice lies at the center of my analysis and conceptual framework, pedagogy, and community involvement? What does the center, the unmarked category, at the end of oppositional continuum of margins mean? When and under what conditions does a positionality become or constitute a margin? For whom? And what's at stake when we classify a positionality as a margin to a particular center? Would we be legitimizing the hegemonic center when we do so? Conversely, how would our analysis shift if movements of the marginalized do not recognize, care about, or define themselves in a center-centered way? Don't care. Standing Rock, US elections, for example. And much like the problematic term Middle East, which is neither middle of nor eastern to the people living in West Asia and North Africa, I'm particularly thinking of anti-colonial resistance movements that do not see themselves as peripheral to the colonial center, but that in fact see themselves as being at the center of their own reality, lived experiences, visions, and strategies. In other words, when the subaltern does not take its cue from the hegemon. Connected to these questions, a third poses itself anew. Can the subaltern speak? And if it can it be heard? I.e., are the intent, desires, expressions of the subaltern received and consumed on their own terms, or are they more acutely distorted, misrepresented, and misinterpreted by the hegemon, and then produced in such a way that make them totally alien when they are reintroduced to and perceived by the subaltern? Finally, given this interlocking dialectic, somewhat similar to, but not quite like Hegel's master-slave dialectic in that, while the master needs the slave to define herself, the slave needs only to break her own chains. As the work of Fanon and others remind us, what possible visions exist for the transformation of relations, interactions, and an alternative praxis towards a more just world?
Next, Abdulhadi talks about the racist stereotypes about Arab, Muslim, and Palestinian communities.
All these examples recall Spivak's notion of saving brown women from brown men, or saving brown queers from brown communities. In this particular case, the communities are Arab, Muslim, or Palestinian communities, which seems that this is part of our DNA. This is part of our genetic makeup. These are not different from feminist majority position and during after post 9/11 views on Afghanistan. This is not very different from Andrea Dworkin, and I know a lot of people like to read Andrea Dworkin because she was one of the major feminists and so on. But she wrote an article. How many people are familiar with her article in Feminista? All right. Okay, only a couple of people. So she wrote an article in Feminista. She insisted that Palestinian society values women dead more than alive. Arlene Pex wrote an article and said that Arab men treat their farm animals better than they treat their women. Even Barbara Ehrenreich, who is one of the most socioeconomic critics, referred to Saudi women in an article as bovine. And in, it was an alternate piece. She argued that, quote, feminism is the best counterintelligence strategy. This was a few years after her well-cited work that Abu Ghraib, the scandal of the U.S. military and intelligence security, basically torturing Iraqi men and women, by the way, because the women's pictures were never released. We have 80,000 pictures of men, of the guards. She said that Abu Ghraib, which let me just say for the people who do not know, this was a prison in Iraq after the U.S. intervention, occupation of Iraq. And what happened is that the security guards, two women and a man, and there was reputed to be another man involved, that basically what they did is they stacked Iraqi men on top of each other naked. They made Iraqi men have, I don't know, that I wouldn't even call it sexual intercourse because this is violence, with dogs, and they've unleashed the dogs on them, and they took pictures. They actually took pictures of them, and they sent them. 80,000 pictures were released in the in the U.S. Congress, and this is not the pictures of the women, because the U.S. Congress thought that the women's pictures were too sensitive. But it's okay to put the pictures about Arab men, Iraqi men, because it's kind of like the discussion was that Iraqi men are particularly sensitive. And I always used to ask, so American men like to be stacked on top of each other and like to be subjected to sexual abuse, just for Arab men in particular? But this is Barbara Ararat, when she thought about Abu Ghraib, she said that Abu Ghraib taught her that having a womb, or what I call vagina ink, is not the basis for unity. In other words, sisterhood is neither powerful nor global if it's not on the basis of principled solidarity.
Abdul-Hadi gave examples of Israeli government officials saying that Palestinian terrorists are so willing to let their children be killed, to stoop so low to sacrifice their people. She said that this was the same kind of discourse surrounding the 2014 Israeli war on Gaza.
And the whole purpose of it is to construct, there is several levels of the discussion. This, and one of the levels of the discussion is that the whole question of naturalizing motherhood and fatherhood, that mothers and fathers are actually naturally, you are predisposed genetically to becoming, have specific feelings towards children when you become a mother and a father. But once that is constructed, then Palestinian mothers and fathers are constructed as parent deficiency. They are not caring for their children. And this is a society that's coward, that puts children in the front because they are themselves are not willing to go and fight the fight. And this has been going on throughout. And it's very, very interesting because during the Israeli war on Gaza in 2014, Israelis were chanting in the streets of Tel Aviv. They had a rally in which they were chanting, and it's caught on video, that there are no schools open tomorrow in Gaza because there are no children left. Why is Israel, which is very concerned about its public relations, what's going on? Why is it that it's allowing this very overt, very racist, very hateful discourse to be well known? There is also an Israeli woman soldier, which is very much like Abu Ghraib, who posed with Palestinian male prisoners. They had blindfolds, and she stood in front of them. So the way the image is constructed, we don't know if the Palestinian prisoner actually even know that she was taking the picture in front of them. She put it on her Facebook. Two is they become part of the background, right? They're not that. And three, it reinforces the image of the Israeli army as the strong that is subduing Palestinians. And there is more. So there is all of this, and this is very similar to Abu Ghraib, kind of like taking pictures, actually, of this horrible and sharing it with the rest of the world. And I would argue that this is not particular to Israel. If we think about the history of settler colonialism, we think, and I'm more familiar with the history of the U.S. Than of Canada. But this was the way in which the settlers, the white settlers in the U.S. were cutting the heads and the scalps of the indigenous people. There is also another, and they were in Vietnam, the U.S. military in Vietnam was cutting off the ears and using them as trophies. This is also in Algeria, very well known. If any of you read the book Colonial Harem, which is, it's a very small introduction by Barbara Harlow, but the book itself by Malik Aloula shows the pictures in which French colonists pose in front of Algerians who are posed, including some sex workers, and they put them together. Some of the images put the Algerians as a heterosexual family. Some of them put two Algerian women to show kind of like some same sex, because at that time nobody was saying lesbian. But and send them back saying, this is what I've been doing in Algeria, and this is what's going on. And all of this is image of kind of like the overt racism and the dehumanization of the colonized by the colonizers. And the only time these things are able to stop is when the colonized achieve victories. And even though South Africa did not achieve the post-apartheid socioeconomic changes that we all hope for, but there was an end to political apartheid in 1994. But I want to talk a little bit about the whole question of cemeteries, the questions of memories, memorials, and mementos that we experienced when we were in Palestine, and that Palestinians experience all the time. And people may not know, just in order for us to bring the conversation that we're talking about to actually make it more real. Because people talk about BDS, people talk about all sorts of things, and it starts being a discussion about academic freedom and academic freedom that. And I think people really need to understand what's going on in Palestine, so this is very real.
Lastly, Abdulhadi talks about how the Israeli state claims to speak in the name of all Jewish people and why this is problematic, and how many of us are implicated in the struggle in Palestine.
Fortunately, there are more and more and more Jews who say, do not speak in my name. But the other part, and the last part of the equation, is really important to think that it is not just Jews and Palestinians. It is implicating every single person. Every single person who lives anywhere in the world, whose government or whose policies are making it possible for Israel to continue oppressing Palestinians, for Israel to continue taking more lands, for Israel to continue to expand, for Israel to call for civic association of people who are advocating BDS, for Israel to continue to have couches on the hilltops and watch as if they are cheering and so on, for Israel to continue becoming much more racist in terms of its dominant, there are more and more and more people saying this is not okay. More and more people saying, you're not speaking in my name either. United States government, you're not speaking in my name. Canada, you're not speaking in my name. We are part of something, and this is the last point. We are part of something called the indivisibility of justice. Justice for Palestine is not a project only for the Palestinians. It is not just a project for the Palestinians. Justice for the Palestine is justice, is a project for everybody who seeks justice. And when we think about it this way, everybody is invested in either being part of the problem or part of the solution. People are either complicit in perpetuating injustice, and that goes for every single struggle, not just Palestine, or they are going to contribute to making a different world that we can all be part of. Thank you.
You just heard excerpts from Palestinian professor and activist Rabab Abdulhadi's lecture titled Revising the Narrative, Critiquing the Canon, Palestine and Feminist Paradigms. That's all for this edition of Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. Make sure to tune in 2 weeks to hear our next episode. And in the meantime, check out our previous coverage and podcasts at mcgilldaily.com/podcast or pick up a print copy on stands now.
Unfit to Print.